Okay, hopefully this will work. You deleted a few? Okay, great. Communings of the Spirit Journals of Mordechai Kaplan, 34 to 41. That was for them. We've got these journals and we digitized them, so you can read them online. You can go to our digital digital library and actually read the digitized images of the diaries online, so and they're quite fast. What? It's not searchable. No, right? I was about to say, no. You want to find something, you look for the date. There is no searchability to it because you know it's very hard to find the software that allows for the scanning and creation of you know the searchability of a manuscript like that. That's what creates the difficulty, right? But what makes it searchable? The answer is not all of it, but the careful selection of work, of pieces from the diaries by Professor Skolt makes it available in a way that it would otherwise not be. So these really complement one another. I remember when we first thought about doing the digitization, and we didn't want to pull the rug out from under you. You were in the midst of, you know, these years of very important work. And I called you and I said, is it okay with you, you know, if we do this? And he said, absolutely, of course, because he immediately recognized that there's great value to having the work available to those who want to slog through the actual original diaries, at least in their images. But this is just fantastic to have access in carefully worked out, carefully labeled selections that really provide us with this enormous insight into who Mordechai Kaplan was. I'll let Professor Skolt say more about that. I would just express all of our gratitude to you for doing this work because this is obviously so significant a figure. I know that you'll be doing some reading from the diary, but I was, you know, kind of leafing through this to look for something that would represent Kaplan that I could remark upon, and I guessed, I hope I'm right, that he would not use as part of his presentation. So, I mean, Kaplan was a very diverse figure, kind of stubborn and a little bit cranky at times, inspiring, very, very powerful personality. The diary entries go from the inspiring to the mundane. This was one that I found that was short enough to use in this context, and I thought would be a wonderful bridge into your remarks. So, this is on Kaplan's comments on seminary students and faculty.
Oh, sick.
Right, exactly. I thought this would interest some of you. This was written on Tuesday, June 19th, 1934. I hadn't realized it's actually my wedding anniversary, not 1934, but the June 19th part. And he writes as follows. At the seminary faculty meeting, Cyrus Adler reported that out of the 25 seminary students who had been recently given a medical examination, students, imagine if that was part of your education here, right, to be given the examinations, only three were reported as of normal health. All the others had either ear trouble or gastric disorders or chronic bronchitis. One was cardiac, and nearly all were flat-footed. It turned out that those who had been reported as doing poor work had something physically wrong with them. Interesting. He senses a connection. Then he goes on and says, how symbolic of the general decay in Jewish life. An old, sickly, and decrepit faculty of nine members appointed to train two dozen more or less diseased youngsters of very mediocre mental ability as spiritual leaders in an age of great turmoil and crisis. I think it speaks for itself, right? And so I introduce tonight's speaker, Mel Skolt.
Well, thank you very much. I'm not sure that people realize that I have a life outside the diary, but I do, and I want to add to my list of activities a rather new activity in the last couple of years called the Kaplan Center for Jewish Peoplehood. A number of colleagues and I established the Kaplan Center. It's primarily a digital creation. It has been spearheaded by Dan Cederbaum, who lives in Evanston, Illinois, a dedicated Keplanian. And we have run a number of conferences that you might be aware of. We ran a rather large conference in Philadelphia that had to do with Jewish peoplehood, and it was live streamed. So you could actually see Yitz Greenberg talking about Jewish peoplehood and Jane Eisner, the editor of the Forward. So it's really a very interesting website. And Kaplan, we have a few audios of Kaplan, not videos, but audios, and text from myself and other people. So I very much encourage you to take a look at our website. It's called www.kaplancenter.org. And I think this, you'll find it useful. So the point is, can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. The point is that Kaplan is the compulsive diarist. The diary is 27 volumes long, and I must tell you that I am always very moved by the fact that it is housed here at the seminary, in the same room, in the same vault with the Rambam and with Yehuda Halevi and all kinds of other important figures in Jewish history. It's 15,000 pages. Kaplan started the diary in 1913, and I put together a volume from 1913 to 1934, which we don't have available tonight, but which you can get online. I suppose one might say that if Kaplan was a compulsive diarist, I am the compulsive reader. I have been reading the diary since 1972. When I first met Kaplan at Camp Sedgwin, he told me about the diary, and I came back to his house, and he took me into his study and opened this closet, and there from floor to ceiling were these large accountant-type volumes, and he said, "This is my diary." Well, the point is that there are all kinds of people that are interesting, but you have to have documents in order to write their biography and write about them. And I felt I had hit the mother lode when I saw Kaplan's closet. The diary occupies a very interesting place in his mental life. Almost, one might say, it's strange in terms of its importance. He says the diary assures him in some kind of way that he exists. "My past as though it were not," he says, "so that I feel forced to turn the pages of the diary to convince myself that I have lived." We find thus, in a sense, it contains himself. We objectify ourselves in what we do, in our children, for example, in our jobs, in our creative activities. And Kaplan objectified his self in his diary. He says, "In my frustration, I turned to writing in this journal as the only means left to me to externalize and render transferable that aspect of my being I experience as my soul, myself, or my reason." So one might say that in a certain sense, it is the repository of his self. There are a number of other more mundane reasons why Kaplan wrote the diary. One has to do with his classes at the seminary. You know that Kaplan taught at the seminary from 1909 until 1963, which means that every person that graduated and became a rabbi in the conservative movement studied with Kaplan during those years. He says at one point that there were some things that he thought were too radical for the rabbinical students at the seminary, and other things that were too complicated for the people in his congregation, that they wouldn't understand it. So that is at the SAJ. So that the diary is more radical and more complicated than Kaplan's other works. It's also written in a more accessible style, because it's not fixed up. And Kaplan, if you've ever read anything of his, you know you must agree with Charles Silberman, who Zichrono Livracha, who knew Kaplan very well and knew his work very well, and he said he could never quote a complete Kaplan sentence because there were always all these subordinate clauses and he gets so involved with himself, it's impossible. This volume begins in 1934 with the publication of Judaism as a Civilization. The first printing sold out rather quickly, and Kaplan spoke all over. He spoke in the South, he spoke in the West, he spoke in Chicago to large audiences. He spoke in Buffalo to audience of 700 people. I didn't think there were 700 Jews in Buffalo in 1934. He also spoke in Troy, New York. I suppose this is, I've already mentioned, because it was a kind of negative thing. He said he was talking to an audience of the subnormal kind. And he tells us that he was introduced by the chairman of the night as writing the most important book since Spinoza's Guide for the Perplexed. I think it's important to understand the significance of Kaplan at this point. Let's remember that in 1934, there was no Heschel, there was no Buber, there was no Soloveitchik, and no Arthur Green. There was Stephen Wise, of course, but in terms of a public intellectual of the stature of these men and their intellectual pursuits, we really find very, very few. Those involved in Jewish life, in other words, were starved for an understanding of Judaism that made sense, that was modern, that was relevant, that was compelling, and where the tradition was given a vote, but not a veto. And so, of course, they went wild, really, about Kaplan, as we see from these book events. There's a photo in the book of his birthday in 1942, and it was in a large hotel downtown New York, and you'll see there were probably 1,000 people there, and it's really quite amazing. He was at the height of his popularity. Now, the point is that the diary was very compatible with Kaplan's essential nature because it is not consistent as a literary kind of genre. In other words, you write, you feel one day today, another day tomorrow, another way tomorrow. And so the diary tends to be full of inconsistencies. It tends to be complex because Kaplan very often stands on both sides of the fence. He stands on both sides of an issue. Let's take, for example, the matter of economics. The 1930s were, of course, a time of deep economic privation in the wake of the stock, in the wake of 1929. And, of course, the most appealing solution in the minds of many people was communism. It was very, very popular to young intellectuals, particularly Jewish young intellectuals, as we saw in the 1950s, which many of us remember from McCarthy. And Kaplan experienced this very directly. At the seminary in 1935, there was a forum in which the title was Communism versus Judaism. So the students in the seminary were struggling themselves with this whole issue. Kaplan, of course, was very critical of communism. He published a book in 1936, which is called Judaism in Transition, and he dealt with communism extensively. He was very critical of Marx and his theories, but privately, he was very attracted to communism because he was a person with a great social conscience. And he was, what Marx said about religion, of course, repelled him. But what Marx said in terms of his social concern attracted him. Sometimes we think about Kaplan as a very rational and cold person, but he was anything but that. I want to read you a selection from 1935 in which he reacts to the capitalism of his time. "I am one of the helpless victims of the infernal capitalistic system. May God's wrath descend upon it with the fury of a thousand hells and shock it into death with the voltage pent up in the storms of vindictive rage engendered in the hearts of the innocent and defenseless against their pitiless tormentors." Well, that doesn't really sound very much like Mordechai Kaplan. So you get some idea that even though Kaplan was very rational in his approach to Judaism, in terms of his personality and in terms of his the way he related to people, he was a very emotional person. He was not cold and rational. And he talks about the struggle within that was going on himself. And he says there was not only a class struggle, but there was a struggle within. And therefore, he is really two people. He is Mordechai, the liberal bourgeois, and he is Menachem, which is his middle name, of course, who is an out-and-out communist. Now, so Kaplan teaches me, he allows a great deal of room, particularly theologically, in terms of, because he stands on so many sides of so many issues. The matter of economics caused him trouble at the SAJ, his congregation, because there were very many wealthy people in the congregation. Kaplan supported the growth of unions, which was an important element in the time, and he comes out against the mayor of Jersey City, who opposed the growth of unions in Jersey City. So there were some people in the congregation, particularly a man by the name of Joe Levy, who was the CEO of Crawford Clothes. I don't know whether any of you remember. It was a very large clothing chain in those years. And Joseph Levy came to him and he said, "Rabbi Kaplan, you have to stop talking about general non-Jewish issues," which is the way he perceived the matter of unions. And of course, as a CEO of a large corporation, he himself was subject to pressure from the union, so he was not very happy. It so happens that Levy, Joe Levy, was the owner of the McAlpin Hotel, which was in New York City. I don't know whether anybody knows the significance of the McAlpin Hotel. Anybody remember that? Yes.
They burnt his prayer book there.
The excommunication of Mordechai Kaplan took place in the McAlpin Hotel, which is in Herald Square, opposite Macy's. I always wonder whether or not the Orthodox went shopping after they burned the book. But the point is that at that exact time, the place where it happened was owned by Joe Levy. I thought that's really very ironic in a certain sense. But I like to think of Kaplan as the courageous, Kaplan the courageous, I call him, because he never really hesitated to speak out. And what he believed is in the tradition of the prophets in terms of speaking out on social issues. Now, Kaplan struggles not only in terms of the matter of economics, but he struggles in terms of his own private religious life. He lived at home until he was 28. He loved his father very much. His father was what we would call today a Haredi rabbi. He had smicha from Rabbi Yitzhak Elchanan Spector and a number of other rabbis in Eastern Europe. And he was ultra-Orthodox. So Kaplan lived at home until he was 28, as I said, and that's a long time. He was infused. There was a lot in his mind in terms of his religiosity. And so he had conflicts about ritual, and particularly about the Shabbat. In September of 21st, 1934, he writes the following. I am writing this at 12 o'clock midnight. This is Friday night. I am writing this at 12 o'clock midnight and am thus violating the Sabbath ordinance against writing. But I suppose the feeling that writing is regarded as much more of an infraction of the Sabbath spirit prevents me from being consistent. Even now, as I began writing, Selma, who is his daughter, who was 19 at the time, happened to walk into the study. And instead of continuing to write, I put away the pen and made believe I was only reading this journal. I am sure she noticed my embarrassment, but she acted as though she didn't. So he is conflicted, and he's honest with the diary. He tells us what's happening, but he's not really honest with his daughter. So, and there were other times that are recorded in the diary when he comments about the matter of hypocrisy, about the matter of doing in private what you do in public. The rabbis commented on this, and he was very, very concerned about it, and he obviously feels guilty, as evidenced in this statement from the diary. Sometimes the matter of observance becomes an issue which is in the family. They were summering in New Jersey in 1934. I like these stories because I come from New Jersey, and so we go down the shore, and I always think of Kaplan when I'm there. So it's he writes it on Sunday, August 19th, 1934. It's at the beach. As soon as we were through with the Sabbath dinner, I think he means lunch, Naomi, one of his daughters, said, this has a you are there kind of aspect. I always think of Ed Murrow when I read these kinds of things. And there's a lot of that kind of thing in the diary. Can we go to the beach with the car? She says. He responds, you can do whatever you want, I said, but it's not my idea of spending a Sabbath afternoon. Then the storm broke loose. For over 2 hours, Judith, Hadassah, Naomi, and Selma, reinforced by Ira, that's Ira Eisenstein, Judith's husband, kept up a barrage of arguments under which, I must confess, I finally crumbled. They demolished my defenses of the customary restrictions of the Sabbath and, incidentally, those of Kashrut. So, this was a problem. The daughters, I mean, I feel it's evidence of Kaplan's feminism. The daughters were not passive. They were an exuberant bunch, and they had their own opinions, and he obviously encouraged that kind of thing. There was one time when they were on a ship, and he was with Lena, and it's Naomi again. He's sitting on the deck, and it's Shabbos, and he's writing. He's sitting on the deck, and he's writing. And so she sits down, and he says, she sits down in a very spiteful way. She sits down, and she says to him, and she lights up a cigarette. And she says to him, you make your rules, and I'll make mine. So the diary is a very fascinating kind of place. In the earlier volume, we meet very many interesting and important people. In the earlier volume, which covers the years from 1913 to 1934, we meet Solomon Schechter, for example. You remember that he passed away in 1915. We meet Chaim Weizmann. We meet Judah Magnus. All kinds of other. Chaim Weizmann, by the way, came to the SAJ every time he came to New York. He liked Kaplan very much, and at one point asked Kaplan to be the minister, as it were, of education in the yeshuv. He had a great deal of respect for Kaplan. Kaplan spent 2 years in Jerusalem between 1937 and 1939, and I think it's very interesting that Kaplan wrote the diary in Hebrew during those 2 years. He was so kind of infused with the atmosphere that he was living in, and we had those translated, and they are in here. So one gets a sense of the yishuv in a very direct way, a sense of the terror. There are Jews that are killed on King George Street, and Kaplan, who was a he has dreams about this violence, Arabs attacking Jews. He was a dedicated walker, as some of you know, and walked around the reservoir in Central Park for a great many years. That also is, by the way, a story in itself, because he walked around the park with a lot of people, Judah Magnus. He walked around the park with Louis Finkelstein and with Ira Eisenstein, and so one could write an interesting article about what he discussed with each of those people. And at one point, it became so dangerous that the Kaplan's wife, Lena, says to him, "You must, if you want to walk, you must walk on the roof." And so Kaplan says, "It's important to have a solid roof under your feet." Then one time he goes down to the bus stop, and who does he meet but Martin Buber? Buber had come, you remember, to Jerusalem in 1938, and they go up on the bus to the Hebrew University on Mount Scopus together. It was July of 1938. So I'll read you this selection. It's very moving, and again, it has a you are there kind of feeling. Yesterday morning at 10:30 a.m., a meeting of the Faculty Senate took place. As I waited for the bus on Talbiya Street, which would take me to the bus that goes to the university, Buber came up. This time, I decided, I assume, because of where I am and because of the audience, that you are familiar with the philosophy of Martin Buber. All real living is meeting, Martin Buber tells us. Encounter, encounter. So listen to what Kaplan says. I have been on all the, this time I decided not to be the one who begins the conversation. As I have been on all occasions I have met him, he has never asked me about myself, and I have had to goad him into conversation. Well, but after 2 or 3 minutes, he began by saying that these days he is reading my book, The Meaning of God in Modern Jewish Religion. He expressed his approach to his objection to my approach. In other words, Kaplan in that book, if you remember, is talking about God as the power that makes for salvation and not as the self. And for Buber, God is the ultimate thou. And so Buber objects to Kaplan's presentation. Buber said that my God is not God because he is entirely immanent. The God of the simple Polish Jew is God, is the God of Israel and the God of the universe. I would suggest to you that this really oversimplifies and reduces Kaplan's philosophy because he's not completely an immanentist at all. I tried to show him that I devote an entire chapter to the idea that God is a force outside of ourselves. You may remember the book that we're talking about is organized on the basis of the holidays, and he talks about the presence of God in his chapter on Shmini Atzeret, if you're interested in looking that up. He responded that this idea does not appear essential, but I think that he has not yet gotten to that chapter in my book. That's what we always say. You know, he's not read my book. He promised that he would write a review of my book in the form of a letter addressed to me, which I never found. I don't think he did. I cannot say, this is a very strange way to put it, I cannot say that we thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. Talking for Buber, but the fact that at least Buber behaved himself humanly, taking into consideration the interests of his colleague, pacified me somewhat. So I kind of wonder, really, whether we have the right and whether it's intellectually makes sense to hold a person to act in terms of their philosophy, because we generally feel that there's a very deep, very important difference between a person, what he says, and the way he acts, that there's a problem here. And maybe if he doesn't take it seriously, why should we take it seriously? I mean, it's an issue. Now, this time of the 1930s is the time of the rise of fascism in Germany and Italy. And we get many statements in which Kaplan very strongly identifies with the suffering that's going on. And it's very, very interesting to me that he says something about fascism, which is very, very relevant to our present situation. I think we all really understand that we're in a time of crisis with respect to our government and with respect to our president-elect. And Kaplan talks in a very appealing way, in a very deep way, which is very moving to me, about what he calls mobocracy, which is an interesting way to put it. So he says the following. This is August 10th, 1939. After mentioning the two factors which have contributed to the rise of mobocracy, I want to point out the principal devices which mobocracy uses as a means of fortifying itself. They are xenophobia, chauvinism, and ignorance of the law. That seems, I mean, when I read that, it just jumped out at me as applying to our present situations. And then after a certain point, this is on page 168, if you eventually buy the book, he says the following. Now, what can religion do to counteract these devices? While I can speak only for the Jewish religion, I cannot but feel that it is subject to the same danger as all other religions. So he says, what can we do and what can Judaism do? To counter xenophobia, it is necessary to stress the significance of the Jewish tradition in the Jewish tradition of the teaching concerning the unity of mankind and the divinity that is in all men. This is the main pragmatic implication of monotheism. In other words, if the simple, obvious thing that we know very deeply in our souls, that if there is one God, then all of humanity is one. To counter chauvinism, it is necessary to appreciate the role of the true prophets. The prophets were critics. They were critics of the government. They were critics of those people in power. They spoke truth to power, as we say. And so we have to remember them encountering the chauvinism. And he even suggests that we might use cases from the courts in the United States in teaching about justice, in addition to using the Torah. I would like to mention another selection in connection with the rise of fascism, which has to do with Christianity. Kaplan was very sensitive and appreciated the primary narrative of Christianity. And he says in a very, very moving selection in the diary, this is from 1940, and he's talking here about the crucifixion. He says that who with any human feeling would not pray to be crucified 1,000 times if such crucifixion would be an end to persecution and exploitation? Very, very moving statement about Christianity. Now, the point is that far and away the most important entries in the diary have to do with Kaplan's understanding of religion, his understanding of God, and his understanding of what he calls salvation. Kaplan has been associated with Judaism as a civilization, obviously, and with the assertion of the primacy of belonging and with group with group life. We think of that when we think of Kaplan. This is the center of his thinking. But my many years of reading the diary has revealed to me the importance of individual fulfillment, the importance of moral perfection of the individual as the key to the meaning of life and the meaning of Judaism. Kaplan calls this salvation, the power that makes for salvation. It's a primary image in Kaplan's philosophy. Civilization and salvation, they are the center. So I'd like to talk a little bit about that, and perhaps with the help of some documents that I want to give you.
Do you have one yourself?
Yeah. Yeah, why don't you give me one? Yeah. Okay.
Take one and pass it back.
Okay, we're passing just for the people out there in digital land. The point, I was told, I studied in the Harvard Graduate School of Education, and I shouldn't walk away from the microphone. And I remember a teacher telling us that if you hand out a piece of paper, don't expect people to listen to you, because they're going to read the piece of paper. And that's, of course, what is happening. Does everybody have a copy? Okay. Now, one of the points that I want to make about Kaplan is that he has brilliant, brilliant ideas, and I continually come across them, but he doesn't follow through. He has the idea, but then he drops it. And the word salvation as the primary goal of individual life is uncomfortable for most Jews because it's central. The idea of salvation, of course, comes from the Torah, from the Bible, from the Tanakh, Yeshua, Mimanei HaYeshua. But it's not an idea or a word that is comfortable for us. And so in the 1930s, Kaplan proposes the use of the word shleimut, which is a very, very fine philosophical term. The Rambam used it. Shleimut is related to the word shalom. It means wholeness. It means perfectibility. And the Rambam, in talking about the Ta'amei HaMitzvot, the reasons for the commandments, says that every commandment has as its reason either Shleimut HaGuf or Shleimut HaNefesh, the wholeness, the completeness, the perfectibility of the body or the perfectibility of the soul. That is the goal. And I'm not saying by any means that Kaplan and Rambam are saying the same thing. But the point is that the word Shleimut is a very, very respectable philosophical term in terms of Jewish history. And one thinks, for example, of the Musar tradition, which Kaplan's father was of the ethical tradition in Jewish history, of which Kaplan's father was a part. Kaplan's father, Israel Kaplan, studied with Israel Salanter before he came to New York. And so there's a direct kind of line from the Musar tradition through Israel Kaplan to Mordechai Kaplan. And here in December of 1938, this is the first selection, is the place where I found this connection, where I first found it, between salvation and Shleimut. The belief in the supernatural revelation of the Torah should be equated with the function of enabling man to achieve salvation. Stated in modern terms, that belief means that Jewish civilization, dot, should help the Jew achieve perfection, shleimut enushi, human perfection, and to realize his highest potentialities or attain salvation. In other words, the purpose of that, it's not that we serve to perpetuate the tradition, but the tradition serves to contribute to our perfection, to our fulfillment. It should serve us. He said that a great many times. And when, he goes on, therefore, a number of Jews find any element in the tradition or prevailing ideology or codes of laws that fails to further that purpose, another the purpose of perfection, moral perfection of the individual, and all the more if it hampers that purpose, they are in duty bound to see to it that such an element be removed. And that's really a kind of a definition of Reconstruction. You have to look at it and see whether or not it serves you, whether you're talking about the Shabbat or Kashrut or whatever you're talking about. And if it serves you, that's fine. I think it's very important to understand that Kaplan was not interested in undermining or attacking the tradition if it served people, if it functioned for people, if it contributed towards their fulfillment. It was those people who did not find the tradition functioning for them that he wanted to help. And there's a lot of people that don't really fully understand that. Israel Leventhal, who was a graduate of the seminary a number of years after Kaplan, was quite traditional. He was served a number of pulpits in Brooklyn, and he and Kaplan talked, and he thought he was a Reconstructionist, but he said, maybe I'm too observant. And Kaplan tried to convince him that you don't have to be unobservant in order to be a Reconstructionist. And that was very important to him. But he did feel that it was important to be dedicated to the central vision of Reconstructionism, and that is in the second selection, which is really a definition of salvation. To be alive, and I must say that I like this very, very much, but I've rewritten it a little bit so that it doesn't have all the subordinate clauses in it. To be alive is to grow. To grow is to become identified with the other and with larger and larger groups, and finally with humanity as a whole. To grow, we must reconstruct ourselves and our environment. Kaplan talks about that, which it seems to me is much more compelling than the idea of reconstructing Judaism. That's something that's abstract, and it's not clear where we should go and what we should do. But he also talks about reconstructing yourself, and that, it seems to me, is very, very compelling. And not only reconstructing yourself, but reconstructing your environment. So I don't want to push the issue, but one might say that Kaplan was also sensitive to the issue of climate change at a time when it was not popular at all. Now, I'd like to say a few words about God, if we could. It's a complicated issue, of course, and very, very complicated in Kaplan. I think we have to differentiate between the belief in God and the concept of God. Kaplan never ceased to believe in God. He believed in God every single day because he davened regularly for a very, very long time. But the point is that his concept of God changed perhaps more often than he changed his clothes. He was the optimist, and his optimism is something that we can benefit from. If you look, I think really what he's talking about, if I could put it this way, is he's talking about the Yetzer HaTov. We more often talk about the Yetzer Hara, the evil urge, which, of course, gives us all kinds of problems. But we don't very often talk about the Yetzer HaTov, the better part of our nature. So he says in the next selection, logically, prior to believing in God as the power that makes for salvation, is to believe in man as capable of salvation. Man is capable of growth. Man is capable of fulfillment, of perfection. That's the Yetzer HaTov. But if we can discern in man evidences of a higher order of being, despite their being overlaid with corruption and cruelty, then we can believe in God. In other words, the belief in God for Kaplan flows from the belief in our own ability to transcend ourselves, in our own ability to act in a moral way. If you go on to the next, to the other side, and as this continues, in the yearning for salvation, and I want you to notice, he doesn't say the achieving of salvation, but he says the yearning of salvation. In the yearning of for salvation, for life's worthwhileness, for truth, goodness, and beauty for their own sake, for freedom, justice, and peace in society, man experiences something suprahuman or supranatural. In other words, Kaplan dismisses supernaturalism. He dismisses God as self. He dismisses miracles. He dismisses God as directing the historical process. But he is a naturalist, I would say, pushed to the ultimate. And that's what he says here. Supranatural. Supernatural, which I feel is really very, very, very important. Now, there are some people who actually come close to achieving their fulfillment. There are models that we have, people like perhaps Nelson Mandela or Martin Luther King. In the diary, Kaplan mentions Eleanor Roosevelt. This was a time before Eleanor Roosevelt became an icon, and he sees her as a model of a person dedicated to the ideals. But in our desire, I must stress, for example, that Kaplan sees the growth through the mitzvah system. He sees the growth through the community. That's very, very, very important. You have to have a set of sancta, as Kaplan calls them. In other words, the way in which you mark holy days, the way in which you mark life changes, the events in the life cycle. You must have that if you're going to grow morally and you're going to grow in terms of your spirit. But sometimes in our effort to transcend ourselves, we become discouraged. And so in the last selection here, Kaplan encourages us. Kaplan is really the ultimate cheerleader in a certain sense, that who wants to keep before us the possibility of our transcending ourselves. This is the challenge or test which each of us has to be able to meet in asserting our mental and spiritual freedom. The assurance that despite our own repeated failures to avail ourselves of our inner resources, and despite the devastations wrought by mankind, the sources of our true selfhood have not been dried up. The faith that we still hold our fate in our hands is indispensable to happiness or the feeling that we are on our way to salvation. And it's kind of selections like that that helped me to keep on going. And that's the philosophy and the diary of Mordechai Kaplan.
Got some minutes, you'll take questions?
Yes, please.
Anybody?
Yes.
I have a very simple factual question. Till what year did Rabbi Kaplan keep his diary?
The question is, how long did Kaplan keep his diary? He started in 1913, and the last entries in the diary are about 1978 or so, when he was 97. And he begins to repeat himself a little bit when he's 97. I kind of think that I'll be happy if I can make sense when I'm 97, if I live that long. But he does keep it till the very end. And it illustrates to me how important it was to him, that which is what I tried to say at the beginning.
Are all the entries on the digitalized source? Are his entire diaries in the digitalized?
The seminary, it's a very interesting story, which I suppose should be told for posterity. It's rather complicated. Kaplan, in his will, left the a diary to his daughters and to the Reconstructionist College. One day, he bethought himself to change his mind, and he came to the seminary, and he said he wanted to deposit his diary in the seminary. And so he did. And so the seminary owns the diary, the seminary has the copyright to the diary, the seminary is where the diary is. But that was only up until, as I understand it, 1966. I think that the two last volumes of the diary are in Philadelphia at the Reconstructionist College.
But he was just repeating himself at that point, so, yeah.
Okay, yes.
I have two questions.
Yes.
The first one is, so when is volume 3 coming out?
And the second?
I asked him about the second after I read the first.
So. Oh.
There it is.
While I was working on the second volume of the diary, I was also working on this book, the Radical American Judaism of Mordechai Kaplan. And so it took me 10 years to finish this volume. Now I'm not working on another book. Well, I have a lot of ideas, but I'm not working on another book. And so I told the publisher that I would finish it perhaps by the end of next year. I mean, that's a hope.
Do you have another question?
Yes, the other part of the question is, and I've heard so many answers to this, Mel, that I figured I wanted to ask you too. My understanding is that Mordechai Kaplan never considered himself a Reconstructionist rabbi, that it was Ira Eisenstein who really established Reconstructionism and founded synagogues. Is that accurate, or did Kaplan describe himself otherwise?
So okay,
I was,
it's
the
a very.
He was already, you know, well past being the rabbi and whatnot.
It's the question, if I can repeat the question, has to do with whether Rabbi Kaplan considered himself a Reconstructionist. I mean, the short answer is that Kaplan was a rebellious conservative Jew.
Right. Okay. That's the way I've always seen it.
Yeah, okay. The longer answer is very, very, very interesting. I won't go into too much detail, but the point is that the recognition of the conservative movement took a long time, I maintain. And in 1918, Jacob Cohen, K-O-H-N, who became the rabbi at Anshei Chesed, and I can't remember his name at the moment, came to Kaplan and said, we would like you to help us establish a third movement in American Judaism. They were members of the rabbinical, they were graduates of the seminary, and people did not perceive the seminary, really. They perceived it as a rabbinical school. It was the rabbinical school, but not as a, there are people that would argue with me about this. Moshe Davis has written a very great book on the history of conservative Judaism, which is really an effort to give it a pass. But that event of those rabbis coming to him and saying, we want a third movement, not a fourth movement, really blew me away. So that when Kaplan left the Jewish Center in 1921 and established the SAJ, he had in mind, and his followers had in mind, to establish a denomination. The SAJ had chapters, and a congregation doesn't have chapters. Kaplan would speak in Scranton or wherever, and they would, at conservative synagogues, and then they would establish a chapter. And it would have happened in 1927, Kaplan left the seminary for a period of 4 months in order to become perhaps the president of the JIR. Stephen Wise thought Kaplan was wonderful, and he wanted him to be president. And there was such an uproar at the seminary by the students. Milton Steinberg was here at that point, and so Kaplan came back. If Kaplan had stayed at the JIR, the JIR would have become the RRC of its time. And so what happened is that Kaplan settled into the idea that it wasn't going to be a denomination, and he called it a school of thought. So if you consider Reconstructionism a school of thought, which is available to everybody, then he is a Reconstructionist. And of course, in order to have a denomination, you have to have a rabbinical school. And Kaplan never left the seminary. The seminary was his home. He came here at the age of 12 and a half in short pants in 1893. And so it was the place where he lived. And only when he retired in 1963 did he lend his name and so on to those people who wanted a denomination. Ira wanted him to leave the seminary in 1941 when the Haggadah came out, because when the Haggadah came out, you know, everything blew up. Everybody on the faculty was very, very unhappy with Kaplan because of the Haggadah, which I assume you're acquainted with, and perhaps you understand why they were unhappy. Yes.
I've read that Kaplan would, you know, put on his thallus and read Emerson, but I've never read an explanation of why Emerson. You know, what was it that he was that he was reading in Emerson that he felt was compatible with his talit?
Well, it's so interesting the way historical things are developed. The story is a little bit different than you present it, and if the story is in the biography, okay, and it's also in here. I copied myself a little bit. The story goes in the following way. I wondered how long Kaplan davened in the morning, and so I asked Ira Eisenstein, and Ira said I didn't know because I didn't live with him. But in 1940, I was at the Jersey Shore with Rabbi Kaplan, and I noticed that every morning he got up and he put on his talus and tefillin, and sometimes he got up and instead of putting on, he put on his talus and tefillin, but instead of reading in the Siddur, he read John Dewey, and he read Achad Ha'am. That's what he told me. So I called this in my book, Davening from Dewey. Now, in other words, I think it's a very, 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 it's a story that I hope you remember, because it is quintessential Kaplan. You would think, so he wanted some mornings to get up and not to daven, and he would just simply read Dewey or read Emerson or read whoever. But it was important to him to put on his talus and tefillin, because that was his spiritual. That was where he lived. In the diary, you'll find it in this book, because it's from the 1940s. Kaplan was working on his Siddur, which came out in 1945, and he took an essay from Emerson, which is the Divinity School Address of 1838, and he made it into a poem. And he intended to put it into his Siddur. He never did. But he intended. He also did that with an essay from Heschel. Heschel wrote an essay in 1942 called An Analysis of Piety. And Kaplan took that essay and turned it into a poem. And that got into the Siddur. Now, the point is that, to answer your question directly, I think Kaplan found the emphasis on the individual and the spiritual nature of the individual and the spiritual striving, which you find in Emerson, very, very appealing. Kaplan apparently read Emerson all his life, and he also read Dewey. And if you know Emerson and you know Dewey, you know that Emerson concentrates on the individual, Dewey, the individual within the context of the group. So one might say that in Kaplan's mind, Emerson was completed by Dewey. I mean, that's really what I believe.
Okay. Thank you so much. So thank you all for coming. As you can see, there are volumes available for sale. The diary, the new book, is $35, cash or check, to the author, and the other is $20. I want to invite you back after the break. We've got talks coming up each month at the end of January, Thursday, January 26th. Neil Natanael, who is a professor of law at UCLA, will be in New York and speaking here on his new book called From Maimonides to Microsoft, The Jewish Law of Copyright Since the Birth of Print. I asked him about Maimonides and the birth of print. He said he liked the alliteration. Okay. And then shortly thereafter, Monday, February 6th, our own professor, Jonathan Milgram, will be discussing his new and very highly praised book, From Mesopotamia to the Talmud, which is about rabbinic inheritance law in its legal and social context. So have a great break, those of you who are taking breaks, and the books are for sale right up here. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
I'll be happy to answer.